Welcome to Calvin's Corner. My name is Phil Nasons, and I'd like to welcome you to the weekly radio show brought to you on Max Sports Channels and the 405 Media, and coming soon to your station. All you got to do is let us know. You can find me over at Phil@PhilNasonsShow.com, and I will definitely be interested in speaking to you about this program. We have a lot to cover today. On the line with me is my co-host. Please welcome the Phoenix Preacher, Pastor Michael Noonan. Michael, how you doing? Welcome to the show. Welcome to your show.
No, it's not my show. It's our show. I'm good, Phil. How are you?
I'm fantastic, man. I'm enjoying this show. It's because I get to talk with you every week, because I missed that the last couple of years while I disappeared into the sports world.
I think you did the better thing.
I'll tell you what, when I call myself, as you know, I call myself a recovering ODM, and I recovered.
I'm still in recovery.
I'd say there's a lot going on, and I'd say you were right. Teddy Bridgewater looked really good on Sunday. Very good for him. I was happy for him.
Well, as a Viking fan, I was pretty excited. The problem, we saw the best and worst of Teddy. He gets the ball out so fast. He's so calm. And then the flip side of it is he's so thin, and is he going to be able to hold up to the NFL? And then we come to tonight. Tonight we're playing Green Bay as we're recording this, and doesn't look like Teddy's going to play. So, it's going to be an interesting year. I want to see everything this kid can do. But he got the big endorsement. Tarkenton likes him. So if Fran says you're good, I say you're good. It's all over.
I agree with that. Fran is the man. I love watching Fran Tarkenton play. The Jets, I don't love watching play.
I feel for you.
Gino, he just has too many interceptions. I'm ready for Michael Vick. I know the PETA people probably aren't very happy about that idea, but I'm ready for Michael Vick. Bring on Michael Vick. I don't care. He's a bulldog.
What do you do with Gino then?
I send Gino to Timbuktu, him and his interceptions and his sacks. Okay, he doesn't have a very good offensive line. All right, we'll give him that. But I send him to Timbuktu.
And he doesn't have really good receivers, and he doesn't have really good running backs.
Neither do the Browns. And Brian Hoyer's having a great season. So, it's possible. But this is New York. Old motto, and they give me agita, really. I can't even watch them. And they play the Lions. and I was like, this was the number one against number two defense. The Jets have a very good defense because Rex Ryan, that's all he really seems to care about based on his draft selections. But, I was just like, oh, man, not again. Why do they start out 1-3? They're awful, Michael. They really are awful. And you know what's awful is when you I've been watching your blog this week, as I do every day. But that blog's not awful, by the way. But this whole Chuck Smith family lawsuit business, what in the world is this all about? Because everywhere you look, there's thousands of comments everywhere. People have their opinions. What is the deal with that?
It's a really difficult situation to parse. The root of this is that this is a very dysfunctional family. All the people are finding out today is what those of us who have worked around Calvary Chapel, written about Calvary Chapel for years, have already known, that this was a family group that was really in crisis and always has been. And so when Papa Chuck dies and there's all of these assets left, estimated Calvary Chapel Costa Mesa assets, the worth there is somewhere around $400 million the last time I looked. And you have these auxiliary things like the Word for Today, which is their radio media outlet that they've used. So you have this infighting now over who was going to take over the pastorate of Costa Mesa, who is going to be in control of all of these assets? At its core, that's what this is about. This is about religious politics and huge amounts of money and people trying to get their cut of the empire. The unfortunate thing in this lawsuit is it led off with a claim that when the night that Chuck Smith died, he was not adequately cared for. So the narrative that's coming out, if you read the LA Times, if you read the lawsuit, if you read media outlets, it's almost a claim of, I don't know any other way to put it, manslaughter. That Smith was not, there was no attempt made to revive him, there was inadequate care provided for him. It's a very ugly claim. That's going to have to be adjudicated in the courts. And the information that I have says it's just simply not true. When you're dealing with someone that's on hospice and has signed what's called a DNR, a do not resuscitate. In other words, if they die, there's not to be any attempts made to revive them. They're at the end of life. That's why they're at home, so they don't have to die in a hospital, so that they can have their son sitting next to them when they breathe their last, like Chuck Smith did. There are very distinct procedures that you go through when a patient is in this sort of situation. And as far as I can tell, and as far as I've been told, all those procedures have were followed to a T. Now, the unfortunate thing is now we have a narrative going out that Chuck wasn't taken care of properly, and Chuck was allowed to die when before his time. That narrative is extremely powerful for people who do not want the current pastor of Costa Mesa to continue in office. There is a power split, a theological split. There's a big split of all sorts of kind in Calvary Chapel today. And before Chuck died, there was quite the battle over these same control issues. Who's going to be the voice of the movement going forward when Chuck's gone? The side represented by Brian Broderson pretty much won that battle. This narrative of they didn't take care of Chuck properly, they're not taking care of his widow properly, is extremely powerful and extremely damaging if it continues without some sort of correction from the other side. The power struggles in Calvary Chapel are not yet over, and we'll see where it goes from here. It's a really sad situation, but on the other hand, just like we're seeing in Mars Hill with Mark Driscoll, you're seeing how these organizations are structured. You're seeing exactly how much money, how much emphasis there is on almost a corporate identity as opposed to a gospel identity. These things can be very instructive, but at the same time, they're very damaging to the people in the pews, in my opinion.
Yeah, from the outside looking in spot that I sit, it doesn't look good for anyone. You know, the one thing that you can find out people's true character when somebody dies and they think they can get something or think they've been slighted. And unfortunately, that's what this looks like from the outside looking in. And it looks petty and it looks immature and it looks like it's not going to end very well for anyone. And that's a sad thing because it's a very ugly mark on Chuck Smith's legacy, right?
It depends on how you define Chuck Smith's legacy. Chuck was not what people thought he was. Chuck was not the always smiling, kind, wonderful grandfather figure to everybody. Chuck Smith could have a real temper. Chuck was a human being. He was very, very smart financially, very sharp man financially. But he was also a person in a position that I'm not sure that he wanted, but that he had no choice but to embrace. And when you are in that position where people lift you up to a point where there's no accountability, there's no checks and balances for your decisions, bad things happen, especially when you start bringing in family members. And even, and the family members that are bringing the suit were very much a part of that Calvary Chapel structure. The daughter that's bringing the lawsuit owned the travel agency. And I don't know, for those people that have been in Calvary Chapel, all of these trips to the Holy Land, that churches all over the country were always signing people up for, all went through her travel agency. The son, who I believe is behind her, did very well, let's say, with the buying and selling of radio stations. Quite a bit of scandal was around that about 7 or 8 years ago. The nepotism, the lack of checks and balances, the lack of accountability creates these situations that when the founder dies, or there's a problem like in Mars Hill where the leader is under accusations of various sorts, when those things collapse and people can see what's actually going on inside the organizations, it's a blight on everything. I don't think we judge the legacy of a Chuck Smith by all of the problems. You judge a person's legacy by the fruit that they've left behind. And whether you agree with Chuck Smith or you don't, or you agree with the governance of Calvary Chapel or you don't, and I think most people are well aware that I've been very critical of both over the years. You judge the fruit, and the fruit is you've got 1,500 churches, you have who knows how many conversions that have taken place over the years. You have an organization that represented the last great revival in this country. And to me, that's his legacy. Part of that legacy may be also to instruct the rest of American evangelicalism how to do things right by doing so many things wrong.
Those are all great thoughts. And I'm sure this won't be the last time that we talk about this situation. We hope it ends well, but as we've seen in past experiences with all sorts of different folks, things really don't end well. This past week, Michael, Ken Silva passed away. Ken was the founder of apprisingministries.com. It was a online discernment site. It was pretty prominent at one time. Any thoughts? I'm a recovering ODM guy, as you know, so I'm sure I have a few.
Ken Silva was not a friend of mine. The interesting thing about what has happened since he died was how many people have come forward talking about what a very decent person that he was offline. That even if he ripped you online, over the phone, he would be very engaging and very kind. I have a real problem with that. I mean, Ken declared me an apostate. He hurt a lot of my friends. His online persona was, in my opinion, very harsh. He was not open to correction. He wasn't even open to new information most of the time. So to me, okay, I have sorrow for the people that knew Ken. I don't have any personal sorrow because I didn't have those kind of positive interactions with him. The issue to me when I look at Ken Silva's life and his death is, as someone who is also a blogger, who writes a lot, who's online, what am I doing that I really didn't like in Ken Silva? Am I open to correction? Am I open to being more of the person that I am at home, privately, online? because we see this all the time, Phil, is that when you speak to some of these people, these ODMs offline, they really are decent brothers and sisters in Christ. Nice people. But online, they're piranhas. I don't think that we can have those sorts of divisions between our professional, if you want to call it that, and our personal personas. I don't think it honors God. And what Ken did over the years to me was sub-Christian at best. He indicted a lot of people in the body of Christ. He excluded a lot of people in the body of Christ based on some really narrow theological issues. And I can't go there anymore. And I think part of what I want to take from this is when people speak about me online and off, I hope that they believe that I was a good and decent person in addition to being a good blogger. But that remains to be seen.
Yeah, you know what? I never had a positive experience with Ken Silva either, and we were kind of quote unquote in the same field, so to speak. Never once did I. One thing that I wanted to do differently was be ethically sound when I did things. And well, let's just say he wasn't. And always, I should say. I can prove that if anyone needs me to do that. I've done this several times. In fact, I had to go to one of his friends because he wouldn't listen to me when he was doing something he shouldn't have been doing. Despite all that, I felt sorry for him because he suffered pretty much his entire, well, his last 5, 6 years at least, physically suffered. But he was awful to people, really awful to people online. He was just a jerk. And you know what? That ODM thing, that can happen. It happened to me, and that's why I took a step back. And you remember when I did that. I know that you do. You know what happens is you're always so busy looking for the faults in people and trying to be tough because, as you know, Michael, people will come after your job.
I'm well aware.
Yeah, I do too. I
And
am
sometimes
too.
I'll get it.
Yeah, and people were writing to the resort in Greece about me, and I just started to get tougher. And the thing is what happens too is these guys, when they run out of people to argue with, they start fighting amongst themselves. And I took a good step back and watched that, and I said, I don't want that to happen to me. And then when it did, that's when I shut down my blog for a couple of years. I said, you know what? And you were with me the night, the 5th anniversary of my blog, because you and I did a show that I can't even publish to this day, on my because of my end, because of my frustrations for the whole 5 years that I spent. And I don't think Ken ever had that issue because, he always thought he was right. And unfortunately, he wasn't usually. And the thing is this. He was a different person offline than you are online, then there's a disconnect somewhere. And hopefully we all learn from this. And as I said on my blog yesterday or 2 days ago, Michael, I just said this. I hope that the God that he professed has mercy on his soul. And I'm going to leave it at that.
Well, here's the good news, is that the God that he knew will have mercy on him. And that's the message that I wish Ken would have embraced earlier. I disagreed with Ken about a lot of things. It was what the funny part is fundamentally our theologies were very similar. The things that we affirmed were very similar. The issue came in regard to the things that we denied. Steve Brown once said that 50% of the things I believe are wrong. I just don't know which 50%. And so he holds everything very lightly. And as I've gotten older, that's kind of the position that I've taken. There are fundamentals as that we have expressed in the early creeds of the church that I think are non-negotiable. The Nicene Creed, the Apostles' Creed, those things that's your foundational beliefs of Christianity. Those are non-negotiable in my mind. Everything else from there on out is open to debate. And I see this desire to be absolutely right on these fine points of theology, and not only be right about them, but to attack people who don't hold to them as being almost profitless in terms of making disciples, spreading the gospel, living the gospel. Someone tried to drag me into a conversation the other day about whether Calvin believed in limited atonement. Well, and to what end are we going to have this conversation? According to the best historians, the best theologians that I've read, and my own reading of Calvin, there's some ambiguity there. There's a lot of ambiguity there. Sometimes he affirms something that sounds like limited atonement, sometimes he takes it away with the other hand. My point is what difference does it make? If I take one side, I'm going to get hammered by the other side. And at the end of the day, the issue's not going to be settled. No one's been edified, no one's been built up. The work of the ministry hasn't taken place. I'm not going to get involved in these debates over eschatology, soteriology, past the point of the things that we can agree on. I have my opinions, I have my beliefs, but I don't think they're worth shooting down another brother or sister and then stomping them every chance I get to advance them. And this is a faith based on grace. And my issue with Ken was that he would not give people who disagreed with him or whose methodology was different the grace to believe they were brothers and sisters and doing the best they could under the leading of the Holy Spirit. And my hope is that when I look in the mirror, that I'm a person who is trying to do that, despite the fact that I have very strong convictions about some things. But in
Yeah,
those
that's
convictions, I can love other people.
there you go. That's what it's all about, really. And you know what? When you're in that ODM world, it's hard to do that because, like I said before, if it isn't Paula White you're stomping, it's each other. And it's over some of the silliest stuff. And you know what? I hope that Ken Silva is in heaven right now. That's what I hope. And I'm
I
sure
don't,
everyone else should too.
yeah, I have no doubt. But I'm not going to be writing nice articles about my great experiences with him. You
No.
know, at the end of the day, when my life is over, I hope that when people are writing about what they experience with me, that it's a lot more positive than it is negative.
That's my hope too, for me too, and that's why I took a step back, and I think it's worked out so far. Speaking of eschatology, a listener wanted to know what we thought about the Left Behind series. That's the Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins books that have been turned into two movies. Those are 16 best-selling novels and two movies. A third is due out later with Nicolas Cage. What do you think about the whole Left Behind mania? That's what I like to call it, Left Behind mania.
I try not to.
Me either.
I'll say this with all the grace I can muster. I don't believe that the pre-tribulation rapture is a scriptural doctrine. Therefore, I don't have much use for the Left Behind series of books or movies. Now, having said that, and directing all of the hate mail to you.
Well, God bless you. Thank you very much.
That's why I'm here. I deflect it all to you, Phil.
Good thing I have a
I
thick
did,
skin.
I mean, I came from the same background that most people in America came from, where that was the doctrine that you were taught, and as I've gotten older, examined the scriptures, examined the history, I don't see it in the scriptures. I don't believe it's a biblical doctrine. Having said that, most of the people that I know that read those silly books, and again, silly is my definition, and we're reading them for entertainment, not for theology. And so if you enjoy that sort of religious fiction, because that's what it is, it's religious fiction, then by all means have at it. But theologically, no, thank you. If you want to read the single best book on eschatology ever written, it's by a gentleman named Jonathan Menn, Menn. It's called Biblical Eschatology. In my opinion, it's going to be the textbook for eschatology for the next 50 years. That's the book that I would refer you to. And I would much prefer that you read Mr. Men's book. I don't think he's a doctor. He might be. In any case, I would much rather you read that than the Left Behind series. But if what you're into is entertainment that's not going to be offensive to you, then have at it. I mean, I read comic books. So.
Oh boy, that's a great segue for me too, because I'll tell you what, I'm a preterist, as everyone knows. And I don't have a lot of I've never actually read one of these books, and I've not seen, wait, is that the movie with Kirk Cameron and his wife in it? Left Behind?
First of all, when you mention Kirk Cameron, I'm not going to be viewing that. I don't watch movies anyway. I'm a very odd person. I don't really enjoy watching movies unless it's the Avengers or Batman.
I don't see too many either.
But yeah, there's been, I guess, and there's one coming out. God bless Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jones. They have made bank on this. And there's nothing in American evangelicalism that will make you more money than some turn on eschatology. People just eat that stuff up, and bless their hearts, they're wealthy. But is it something that I tried once to read the first one, because I mean, believe it or not, there were people in my church reading these things, and it's like, I can't do this. I can't do it. I did not think it was worth the time for me to put in. But it's entertainment and it's a diversion. It's not great theology. So it's not for me to judge what people choose to spend their time on. But as long as you're not looking at this as the last word theologically on the subject of the end times, go for it.
Yeah, the problem is that people do. I've heard ministers refer to this book and this movie. Yeah, it is what it is. Eschatology is a non-essential unless it defines an essential. So I kind of just cringe, pray that God blocks my ears for the next 15 or 20 minutes if he's talking about it, he being a minister or from some pulpit. And other than that, I kind of ignore it. Other than to say bravo to Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins, because it isn't easy to have one best-selling novel, and they've got 16 of them. That's pretty good.
It's amazing.
It's an empire what they have there. That's bigger than a. That I'm serious. That's probably the biggest grossing Christian series there is. Has to be.
It has to be. And I will tell you, I have not contributed to the growth in numbers for the Left Behind series.
And nor have I, and nor will I, other than
Nor
the
will
fact
I,
we
yeah.
just gave them a plug today, sort of, but it's okay. I don't mind. We panned it, we kind of bagged on it, so it's okay. And
Well,
that's
I tried
fair.
to bag on it nicely.
Well, you did a good job, by the way. I was very I'm very proud of it. Look at you've really slowed down in your old age, my friend.
Thanks, Phil.
Because I'm the same age as you, right in there. So I feel like I have too, you know? Because there was a time I would have ripped the daylights out of this thing.
Well, I hopefully I've mellowed. Well, this goes back to what we were talking about earlier with Ken Silva. I don't agree with the eschatology. In my heart of hearts, I think it's a huge waste of time to read stuff like this. But if we have brothers and sisters who read them for entertainment value, feel good about, the escape that they made into fiction, who am I to judge it? If you want to discuss the actual biblical eschatology with me, that's a whole different subject. But we get so caught up in trying to make sure that everybody's doing things the way we think they should do them, that we make all of these little prisons for people to dwell in. And the scriptures say that those who've been set free are free indeed. And it means you're free to read badly written fiction novels if that's what sets you, if that's what gets you going. And it's just not going to be an issue to me that I worry about a whole lot.
Yeah, that makes sense to me too.
Because the issue that I'm worrying about now is getting all of my electronics turned off so that we don't hear constant beeping
Yeah,
throughout
somebody brought
all
that
of
up to
these
me and they go,
podcasts.
"You need a better producer." I said, "Well, we fired him and we have a new one this week." So, but I didn't even, you know what, when I was at it, because I don't listen to the entire show when I do this, because as you know, I do a lot of producing and I'd forgotten that that beep was in there, and then I heard it once and I couldn't get rid of it, and I just said, "Yeah, it's okay." You know what? It just means that
It's
you have
my
a lot
fault
of
too.
mail.
I do get a lot of mail, and especially when we're running a story like the Chuck Smith stories, my phone literally sometimes overheats, and so we've got all of my electronics going off, and I apologize to the listeners for all the beeping that they've had to endure for the last 3 weeks,
And to the producer too, who has to
and to
try
the
to read.
producer too, and to the one that we fired.
Yeah, well, boy, he was angry too when he left. But it is what it is. You know, Michael, it's time to open up the book, the good book, or in this case, my
Left
e-source,
Behind.
electronic, and not the Left Behind. I'm leaving that behind. And instead, I want to read from Ephesians chapter 2. I'll start with verse 8. "For by grace you have been saved through faith." And this is from the ESV, not the Mark Driscoll version, but the actual one. "For by
Yes.
grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not your own doing. It is the gift of God, not a result of works, so that no one may boast." Grace, Michael, if you're talking about Calvin and you're talking about grace, here we go.
Well, you can't start at verse 8.
Well, we could start it at verse 1, but I wanted to hit the highlight first.
Well, because the point that Calvin's going to make begins actually in verse 3,
Right.
when he describes, when Paul describes us as people who all once lived in the passions of our flesh, carrying out the desires of the body and the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, like the rest of mankind. But God, being rich in mercy because of the great love with which He loved us, even when we were dead in our trespasses, made us alive together with Christ. By grace you have been saved. The point that Paul is making, that Calvin believes Paul was making, that I believe Paul was making, is that your salvation is all of God. Because there was nothing in you to deserve it. You were a person that was dead spiritually. Dead people, as a rule, can't do anything to help themselves. Dead people can't choose to be alive again. It has to be something external, not something internal, that brings us to a point of spiritual life and understanding. And so Paul is telling us that our salvation had nothing to do with who we were, because we were children of wrath. We were formerly lost, but now God, by his grace, has rescued us from destruction. And Calvin goes on to say, he does not mean simply that they were in danger of death, but he declares it was a real and present death under which they labored. Spiritual death is nothing else than the alienation of the soul from God. We are all born as dead men, and we live as dead men until we are made partakers of the life of Christ. It's all his work, not ours.
So we don't cooperate. There's no way we can cooperate with our salvation. It has to be from God.
Dead people can't cooperate.
Right. That's
dead
what I
people
try to tell
are
people.
Dead.
That's what I try to tell people, but they seem to think, you know, it's really interesting when you listen to some ministers who believe that, you know, we cooperate, you know, the free will guys, the Arminian folks, some of them anyway. Is God did this. God brought you here. God made sure you did all these things, but God couldn't save you. He needed you to help him. And I'm like, huh? Come on, you guys. You got to be kidding me.
You know what the worst explanation of this is?
Which one?
That I've ever heard. And there's going to be people that are listening to this podcast that will have heard this preached to them from a pulpit. God voted for you. The devil voted against you. You cast the final vote.
I've heard that before.
And I always want to stand up and go, are you serious?
Yeah, I know. Sometimes you hear some of the funniest things. And it's only to, you know, try to explain it away. Or there's no way they can explain it, so they just try to explain the unexplainable. And if they've read the book of Ephesians, the book of Romans, you would know there would be... Really, it'd be difficult to teach other than the way Calvin taught about grace and salvation by grace alone through faith alone. And you just don't see that a lot of times. And it just makes me shake my head, Michael.
It's understandable because we live in an age where people believe that they're better than they are. I believe I'm better than I am. We all do. And we want someone to tell us that we are actually in control of our own fate. It's the American way. You're the captain of your own ship. You're the master of your own destiny. Not spiritually. You were dead in your sins and trespasses that you used to walk in. And God made you alive. God did it. All the glory goes to God. You don't get any credit that you were somehow better, wiser, nicer than your neighbor and made a good decision. That's not how it worked. It's all of God. Now, we might talk about this someday, but we don't cooperate in that. That's a sovereign act of God. But we do cooperate in our sanctification. That's why it's important to separate justification from sanctification. One is a process that's totally the grace of God. Sanctification is something that is, at the end of the day, totally the grace of God, but you are called to cooperate in. You are called to strive. You are called to work. You are called to be a person who strives to live a holy life. You have to hold these things in tension. And you have to also understand that the words that are being used to describe why God does these things are what's really important. He's rich in mercy. He did it because he loved you. It's all of grace. Grace, mercy, love. Why does God choose one and not the other? Grace, mercy, and love. That's all we know. We don't know the mechanics behind it. We don't know the reasoning behind it, nor are we going to know. What we are to focus on is being grateful and thankful that we were chosen, that he poured out that grace, that mercy, and that love on us. And then... We want to take that to the world and demonstrate that our Father is full of grace and mercy and love to people who don't yet know it.
Yep, that's right. Justification. Just as if I never sinned. And the only one who can do that is God. You can't cooperate with that. And I think that's important. And the sanctification process is a different situation altogether. And I'm glad that you made that distinction because a lot of people don't know the difference, Michael. And I think it's important that we make sure that they do because there's two different things, right?
There are two different works of God. At the end of the day, they're both still all of God. But the point that I want to make here is that what we're trying to do here is teach the scriptures faithfully according to our understanding of them. The issue isn't that we believe completely in the sovereignty of God and we just want to defend the sovereignty of God no matter what. If that's why you read Calvin, if that's why you study the scriptures, is to prove a theological point, you've missed the whole point of the theology in the first place. The point is God is gracious, merciful, and loving. So are we to be. The message that we take to the world isn't about limited atonement or the sovereignty of God or God's sovereignty and salvation. It's that we were saved by a God who is full of grace, mercy, and love, and he offers the same to all of you. That's the distinction that I wish our brethren in the Calvinist and Reform movements would make.
There you go. Right.
It's not a theological argument. It's let's win people to this God who isn't parsing theology, he's offering grace, mercy, and love.
Exactly. And when you go back to that ODM culture, that ODM thing, these guys don't read books, or a lot of them don't read books because it's going to benefit them. They read the books because they can find an argument to use so that they can win the fight.
Well,
And
it's not just ODMs, Phil. It's all of it. I did it for years.
me too. I'm telling you, me too. And you know what? Now when I read the commentaries, I look for something different. I look for pastoral talk to me, someone who's been there, who understands the scriptures, and can help me be better in the sanctification process.
Exactly. And let me give you one more from Calvin here. And this is from Calvin's commentary on Ephesians. He talks about the fact that we were dead in our sins and trespasses, and that God sovereignly raised us from the dead. And he says, on this ground, he praises the mercy of God, meaning by its riches that it has been poured out in a singularly large and abundant manner. The whole of our salvation here is ascribed to the mercy of God. But he also adds, for his great love wherewith he loved us. This is a still more expressed declaration that all was owing to undeserved goodness, for he declares that God was moved by this single consideration. Herein, says John, is love. Not that we loved God, but that he loved us. We love him because he first loved us. That's where we
Excellent.
want to go.
Excellent. That is absolutely perfect. That's from the Calvin Commentaries, Ephesians chapter 2, I believe, right?
Exactly.
Okay, you can find that. You know what? If you're really clever, you go over to eSword and get it for free, and you'll have no excuse, but check them out. Read Calvin's Commentaries. If you've never done it before, and you really just want to be enriched and to be aided in the sanctification process, John Calvin was more than just what you've read. He was a great pastor. He was very pastoral. He was an incredible writer, and he ministered to people directly. You can Google online and read some of the letters that he wrote. And some you'll learn so much more than you will in this 15 minutes. And it'll help you understand where we're coming from too. Michael, great stuff today. We'll catch up with you next week.
Awesome, Phil. Thank you.
Thank you. That was Michael Noonan. I'm Phil Nason, and this was Calvin's Corner.